Just a quick message before the episode gets underway. The Aurora Renewables Summit London is returning on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 26th of June. Book your ticket now to hear from leading experts in the energy industry as they assess the opportunities and challenges within the UK and the wider European renewable sector. You will also benefit from unparalleled networking opportunities. We look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome to Energy Unplugged. I'm Hugo Batten, Managing Director of Aurora in APAC. We've got a slightly different Energy Unplugged today. We've done a few of these previously where we bring on the Aurora team and no external guests and talk about a particular issue. We've done this for capacity markets and locational marginal pricing. This episode, we're talking about grid modeling, particularly in APAC, but I think a lot of the principles will be applied outside of APAC. So we'll touch on locational marginal pricing, but we want to spend the bulk of the time on the grid and modeling it, both from a policy perspective and an investment perspective. To discuss this topic today, we're joined by Kento Yoshimura, market lead for Japan.
Great to be on.
Rowan von Spreckelsen, head of new markets for APAC.
Thanks, Hugo.
And James Ha, our research lead for APAC.
Thanks, Hugo. Good to be back.
Well, welcome, team. Let me lead off with an overview of the discussion we're going to have, and it's going to be in three parts. The first is there are lots of policy and modeling debates around locational pricing and curtailment signals globally, particularly in Japan and Australia at the moment. We're going to spend relatively less time here, but we are going to have a look at what are the spectrum of options, some pros and cons, and then some issues around implementation, policy coherence, those types of topics. The second area we're going to cover is around the detail of modeling debates. And so we're really talking about two types of modeling here. One is modeling the policy and implementation of sharper locational price signals. And there's an increasingly heated debate around both the quality and reliability of this modeling. And then secondly, we're going to look at modeling outcomes for individual assets from locational price signals. So both how different countries do it, but what are some trends we're seeing? And finally, we're going to talk about market responses to rising grid issues. So how are we seeing clients innovate, whether that's co-locating renewable storage and demand centers in the one spot or whatever it might be. So those are the three topics we're going to hit. If we could start with the policy debates around locational price signals and the modeling that flows out of that. Let's just talk about the spectrum of options, because I sometimes think this is a little bit simplistically described as kind of full nodal or nothing, and the truth is ever is much more complex. When we think of full nodal markets, often it's California, ERCOT, the Philippines. Rowan, could you touch on some of the markets you've seen and the kind of key features of those nodal markets?
Yeah, so those are definitely the kind of common examples used. They generally all follow a fairly similar structure in that the market as a whole is split into thousands of different nodes, every location for generators or load in the system. So, for example, Kaiser or California has got about 2,000 of these in their system. ERCOT is maybe double that, around 4,000. And at each of these particular nodes, they see a price signal. Rather than just having one for the whole of the country, they have an individual price signal at each node. And that locational marginal price signal is composed of a couple of different parts, which the theory goes is that that encompasses not just the cost of the energy at a system level, but it also starts to try and send a price signal that accounts for congestion and for losses as well in there as well. And the general principle is that there is a system-wide cost of energy, as in most markets globally. But then on top of that, the cost for congestion is essentially a positive value if there are import constraints, i.e. it's hard to get power to a certain area. And so that raises the price and incentivizes generators to build in areas where it's hard to get power in. So you want to build something locally there. And that value could be negative if the opposite is true. And it's a kind of disincentivization for generation to build or an incentive for load to build in that area. And then the final component is that losses one. Similar concept as congestion, but it's actually done relative to a reference point within that particular market. And it's an accounting for how many losses are there to get power from A to B. Typically, the reference point is kind of the major demand center or kind of a key point in the network. And that way, it's a way of accounting at a nodal level at every individual point and sending a single, theoretically quite efficient price signal to every generator and every load in the system to allow a kind of efficient dispatch and investment in the market.
And again, the truth is usually, that's a great summary. The truth is usually more complicated. So I know in California, you know, nodal pricing, but then they also have sub rules, for example, that try to stop people at particular nodes exerting undue market power. So there's almost a second overlay to the nodal to look at the degree of competition at the node. I'm not actually sure how that works in practice, but these systems are as well as you've described it, are rarely quite as pure as that. So full nodal, zonal is typically the next thing we think about, James. Australia's a zonal model, but again, it's more complicated, right? There are five states, each of them have their own price, but there's a ton of other price signals as well.
So both Australia and Japan are classic examples of zonal markets, Japan with its 9 price zones and Australia with its 5 zones, which really represent one for each of the states that comprise the national electricity market. Australia's a bit of a hybrid market though, in that it does have these price zones where within the zone, the wholesale price is the same for everybody in the trading interval. But then overlaid on top of that, we have sharper locational signals that are provided through two mechanisms, one being loss factors or the marginal loss factor, which is actually a way of building in a form of nodal pricing into the Australian market. But instead of being like CAISO or the Philippines, where that nodal price varies in every trading interval, it's just a single factor that generators get at each node for the year. So it's not really true nodal pricing in that sense. And then congestion is managed through various constraints. When AEMO runs the market, they use security-constrained economic dispatch, which means they take into consideration limits on the transmission network and other sorts of constraints when deciding which generators to curtail. A consequence of that is that you get a locational signal being provided through volume risk rather than necessarily through price risk.
And then could you also talk a little bit, I mean, there's almost another set of price signals, James, in terms of the renewable energy zone, the RESs, where, and again, you're far closer to the detail of this than I am, where you can get favorable treatment or preferred access if you are willing to build within a certain geographic area. And what the government's trying to do, state and federal, is coordinate the entry of new generation, build transmission to it, and essentially just simplify the problem a little bit.
That's right. This is quite a big departure from the historical open access regime that the NEM has had, where generators don't have sort of firm access to the network. They can be curtailed if there's, you know, too much power is, you know, flowing through certain lines and be turned down due to thermal grid curtailment. Or turned down due to other sorts of constraints. The renewable energy zone approach is a departure which says for generators that connect to the zone, effectively they'll be guaranteed a certain level of congestion within the zone. The way that's guaranteed is by limiting how many megawatts can actually physically connect to the zone. So rather than being a sort of financial right, it's sort of a physical limit on who else can connect in that area, as a way of trying to ensure that generators that connect have confidence about the congestion outcomes that they might face, which is something that has been repeatedly brought up in the open access regime as a potential barrier to investment.
Terrific. And then I suppose at the other end of the spectrum is a market like the UK, which has a single price for an entire geographic area. Although even that market has various grid charges based on location. So TUOS and DUOS, which in theory penalize people for building in the wrong locations. So it's rare to see a market with absolutely no locational signals, a big kind of complex market with a reasonable degree of renewable penetration anyway. Again, I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because it's pretty well-trodden ground. But when people talk about the key pros and cons of sharper price signals, they typically talk about it in three buckets. One, efficiency of investment. Two, efficiency of dispatch. And then three, I think, a kind of broader bucket that touches on implementation, policy coherence, the consistency of reforms. James, do you just want to give a kind of summary of the efficiency of investment argument? And it could just be a few lines here, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe if we start on the generation side. So when it comes to the signals about where to make sure generation goes in a way that's useful for the system, usually we see either a price signal or a volume signal. So as we just discussed on the Australian system, you know, within a state, generators might receive the same wholesale price, but they'll face those loss factors that affect actually the price that they receive on an annual basis. And they also face curtailment, which is a volume risk. So long as generators are able to accurately forecast these risks, then in theory, they should be able to build in efficient locations. But there's some examples of this not happening in the markets like Australia, because you know, forecasting can be very challenging. And as we talked about with the open access regime, it can be very difficult to protect yourself as an incumbent generator when someone gets built next door. And the kind of classic example here in Australia, the most extreme example, is the Broken Hill solar farm, which saw its marginal loss factor decline from 1.25 in 2018, which meant back then it was getting a 25% premium on the wholesale price, declined down to 0.76 in 2020. So it was then receiving a 24% haircut to the wholesale price. And this was because additional generation was built nearby. The main question is really around who bears locational risk when it comes to investment as well. So in the NEM, we put it squarely on generators, both through the loss factors and the curtailment revenues. In theory, putting that risk onto the generators should sharpen the signal to locate in the right spots. However, there's obviously higher cost for developing those projects because of the risk that introduces. If we contrast that with the GB, the Great Britain approach, where you know offshore wind farms, where their energy is not able to make it to market, are still paid even when they're curtailed. In that system, the risk of that curtailment is being borne by consumers. So in some ways, it blunts the signal for investments to go into the right locations.
And then potentially, again, very briefly, efficiency of investment for transmission itself.
Yeah, the efficiency of investment for transmission, it kind of comes down to how well you do the counterfactual analysis when figuring out whether a transmission upgrade is required or not. It's almost less of a zonal nodal question because it comes down to ultimately forecasting the net benefits to the system from a system cost perspective. I think probably the one example where it can be quite challenging is around using storage assets as transmission assets. You know, there's an appealing logic to putting a battery at nodes where there's you know, a higher amount of basis risk and being able to arbitrage that risk. And of course, that's only really possible if you do have those nodal price signals. But it's not as easy as it sounds because you have to be able to capture that value. That basis risk could be temporary because you could see more storage get built nearby or transmission line upgrades come in that remove that risk. So for storage that wants to come in as transmission, it might be easier to do that through a regulated asset base or else needing some kind of long-term contracting structure that allows you to capture that that unrealized value.
Yeah, and we've kind of already hit, well, we're hitting efficiency of dispatch. I mean, I think, you know, Rowan, in some ways, it's fairly, the argument here is fairly obvious. And what it avoids is kind of blunt out-of-market redispatch mechanisms. In UK, that's done through the balancing mechanism. I think the Germans have something called quite literally redispatch because generations in the north demands in the south, and they have to pull all sorts of levers to make that work, given it is a single price zone. Is there anything you'd add to that kind of efficiency of dispatch pros cons point?
No, I think Japan is another example there. Is seeing exactly the same thing. There's almost three different methods sequentially to manage that congestion and curtailment, and three different processes. And I think that one of the added challenges here is often you've got older generators that can't receive these signals very efficiently, and then you have to kind of complicate the system further by overcompensating for those newer generators that can receive these types of signals, and then penalizing those that can't. And you get into quite a complex situation of kind of refunds post the event to manage the system versus, I think that's one of the pros of the locational marginal pricing is to have this efficient single signal that can be sent as part of the kind of day ahead or intraday markets.
Yeah. And then finally, Kento, and maybe we're asking you to put on your Meti hat. So Kento served in Meti, the very powerful and famous Japan Department of Energy and Industry and other stuff. In terms of embedding sharper locational price signals into a kind of well-executed, coherent set of policy shifts, what are some of the kind of debates or challenges you see there?
So there are several aspects we need to consider. So first is about like high quality implementation. So this means that clear sign posted information and also very transparent rule are necessary to provide some degree of forecasting to market players. So by having this kind of foundation, market players can actually like quantify its economic impacts under like business environment in a robust manner.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think that was one of the debates that kind of flared up in the UK. A lot of this was about 2035 market design. But if we're in 2024 and it takes you 5 years to implement the policy, and a lot of our people have already made their siting decisions, how much impact actually does changing locational price signals have over a 10 or 15 year period? No, that's definitely one. Any others that spring to mind?
Yes. So another point is the coherence of policy. So for instance, it may not make sense to start LNP regime and also put a significant amount of like renewable through feed-in tariff or CFD scheme. So therefore, it is important to ensure that current and also future policy mix are suitable for the LNP reforms. And I think that is what always like, government policymakers are thinking, what is the right timing and what is a right policy mix to introduce.
Yeah, I think that's a really important one. That kind of policy coherence point, I think, has been particularly acute in Australia, where you have the state-federal split, but also a number of other kind of regulatory actors. So you have the government introducing new contracts to essentially provide floor and ceilings to renewable returns. At the same time, you've got the regulator who wants to materially increase the price cap. And in some ways, those policy shifts are pointing in slightly different directions. I think the example you bought is a slightly stylized one, but I think totally the right one in that you're introducing potentially sharper locational signals, but you're also protecting renewables to some degree from both temporal and locational price signals. You're potentially pushing in two very different directions there. Although, of course, policymakers are thinking about that. A couple more, maybe just to wrap up, that spring to mind just in terms of the challenges.
Yeah. So also not only generators, but also consumers will face LNP. So this means that consumers, especially like with large electricity demand users, need to think about where is the optimal locations, considering future congestions, which might be very difficult for them to predict. And at the same time, which can be politically not popular.
Mm. Yeah, no, totally agree. And I think the last one that really springs to mind for me is just these debates around switching costs, which we already kind of touched on in terms of implementation. But it is not costless. And, you know, major shifts like this, particularly as you're kind of midway through the transition, do create uncertainty for investors. And we'll get to that in a second in terms of impacts on WACC. Okay, so we kind of set the policy debate scene. Really, we wanted to spend most of the time on the modeling debates. And I think just to ground it, when we talk about modeling sharper price signals, typically there's kind of two types of models at play. And so just before we kind of get into the details of some of the modeling challenges, maybe James and Rowan, could you both have a crack at explaining to our listeners when we're modeling things like sharp locational price signals, how do Aurora's models work and why is it hard to do well?
Maybe I'll take the first pass at it, Rowan. Aurora's core power market model, the kind of first one that we developed, really aims to do the long-term capacity mix of the system as well as half-hourly dispatch. When you're forecasting something like the composition of a power system out till 2060, it is challenging to build in too many degrees of freedom to that model around where that investment could go. So Aurora does look, you know, deeper than just the high-level market. We would look down at regional levels, even within regions. So for example, within Australia, down to renewable energy zones to assess the resource quality of wind and solar in those locations, and to think at a high level about how you build in real-world constraints around transmission and loss factors. But it is very, very difficult to kind of go down to the nodal level when forecasting the long-term capacity expansion of the system. And in a market with, you know, thousands of nodes, it just means there's thousands of possible places, and you know, models would take days, if not years, to kind of converge if you were trying to go down to that level. So what we do is we produce a capacity mix. It's at that slightly higher level of granularity, so maybe at the renewable energy zone level. And it also produces a 30-minute or one-hour price and dispatch forecast. We then take that price and dispatch level of outcomes, those price and dispatch outcomes, and feed them into a separate power flow model where we do model every node in the system, the transmission network between them, knowing the electrical characteristics of those lines to determine where would power flow if those were the dispatch outcomes that we that were to occur. And what would that mean for loss factors, for curtailment, in some markets as well, for nodal prices? And that network model then informs some of the inputs and parameters that we feed back through to our main power market model, because we can test things like how robust different parts of the network are to new capacity, how that would affect, again, loss factors and congestion in those parts of the grid.
Yeah, and I think just adding on that as well, it's the consistency between those two models, and it's the kind of conversation that kind of outputs of one influence the inputs of the other, and there's a feedback loop, is really important, because you often see situations where, for example, I think in the context of curtailment as an example, often economic curtailment, which is typically done at this kind of regional level or slightly higher granularity, is different to the grid curtailment, which is then done in this second type of kind of full network flow modeling. It's more the electrical engineering exercise. And you don't want to be kind of double kind of counting downside on top of downside, that needs to be that kind of feedback loop and talking to each other. I think the other one to just draw on that is that probably even more so than market modeling, the grid modeling sees these really big kind of non-linear step changes in outcomes. And where I think the market modeling, the capacity expansion modeling, is not straightforward, but it's an order of magnitude kind of more complex thinking about the network side of things, and you're thinking about individual line flows, and it can be incredibly binary that one asset might be fine until suddenly you double the capacity because a new plant comes in alongside, and suddenly the lines nearby are seeing congestion or curtailment, and you see massive changes to whether it's locational marginal pricing or curtailment signals. And that can radically change the economics of an individual asset overnight. And that type of kind of non-linear step change is something that you need the granular model for. There's kind of history is not going to be the kind of the replica of what the future is going to look like there.
No, I totally agree, Rowan. And one of my long-term observations at Aurora is, as many of our subscribers will know, we do these quarterly sessions. Typically, they're market modeling focused, although increasingly grid modeling focused. And I noticed that when we kind of sit people down for 3 hours, as we've just done in Japan, to talk about grid modeling, it's much harder to tell coherent stories and narratives that are easy to understand in PowerPoint form. And so there's something about the kind of black box nature of grid modeling that I think makes it hard, particularly for policymakers, but also investors, to actually understand what's happening. And I think particularly some of the debates in the UK, and we'll get to this, about the benefits of sharper price signals, it often seemed to be people talking past one another because it was very difficult for them to fully comprehend all the inputs and methodologies that had gone into one another's grid models. And so I think that's a big part of the story as well. So, I mean, I might get to that now. So when we talk about modeling grid, we typically talk about two different things, as I said. One is modeling the policy of sharper locational price signals, and then one is modeling outcomes for individual assets. Nodal prices, losses, curtailment. And so the first one, modeling the policy, I think, is particularly hard to do well. I think the results are typically dependent on three factors that are often buried in Appendix 2C. One is your assumptions around what shifting price signals does to WACC. There's some academic literature about that, but people have very strong views about it. People have run surveys, but I don't think it's something that people agree on, but usually is a major driver of what benefits there are or are not to shifting to sharper price signals. I think the second one is the counterfactual you design. So if you assume sharper price signals leads to better generation and transmission deployment, the implicit assumption is that reduced or an absence of price signals leads to worse siting decisions. And so you're almost deliberately assuming the system will evolve in a suboptimal way to then get benefits from changing the policy apparatus. And those counterfactuals, I think, are pretty keenly debated. The third is to the extent to which I think various kind of out-of-market redispatch mechanisms can fix the dispatch problems without nodal price signals. So is making some crude adjustment through the balancing mechanism, does that get you 80% of the value? Do you really need to go full nodal to capture the value? So when I kind of have looked at the various papers on this topic, that's what I see results as being dependent on. And again, I think that manifested itself really in the UK, where between various market consultants, but also senior energy leaders and policymakers, there was some quite sharp debates because I think very high benefits were forecast and then attacked. And it was ultimately very hard for policymakers to discern and unpick the modeling. So Energy System Catapult released a report that talked about 28 billion to 51 billion Great British pounds in benefits for UK consumers. That was heavily attacked for assuming poor generation site locations in the counterfactual, for ignoring redispatch options, and for making some fairly conservative whack assumptions. So there's some of the kind of challenges I see on the policy side of grid modeling. What's often more relevant for our listeners who are, you know, typically developers or investors is modeling outcomes for individual assets on the grid. So Kento, I might ask you to come in here. Why is kind of the more granular grid curtailment loss modeling difficult to do, just at a high level?
Yeah, so just in the high level, there are like mainly three reasons. One is about lack of data. And second is lack of kind of in-house modeling, because the network model itself is quite complicated. And the last is about integrate in with the market modeling, because the scenario needs to be consistent.
Yeah, and just to pick up on the first point you made there, which I think is a really important one, you know, we've recently, well, not recently, but we're now in Australia, Japan, and Philippines, and it's almost like watching three stages of the evolution of really grid data transparency. So Australia is incredibly transparent, grid snapshots, high degree of granularity, relatively easy to get. Japan, we've just finished building our grid model. You know, we had to go to each EPCO. The data was not clean. Our team spent at least a year cleaning, sorting, organizing that data. But it was there. It just took work to get. I think in the Philippines, we're finding it very hard to get good grid data. It's just not available. And it means it's very tough for individual asset owners, I think, to get good grid modeling. So I think that data, I think all the points you made were accurate, but that data point is very valid depending on which country you're in. What are some of the kind of common errors or issues you see with asset-specific grid modeling, Kento?
Yes. So one typical one is that using historical regression data. So this is one of the most like common pitfalls of grid modeling. So some of the assets have not seen any grid curtailment before, but it doesn't mean that it will not have grid curtailment in the future. And also here, we need to think about what could be the step changes, such as future new plants or like asset retirements and line upgrades. So in Japanese context, for instance, like nuclear restart or like nuclear retirement timing are quite important, as well as network augmentation plans by TSOs.
Yeah, makes complete sense. And then James Rowan, maybe from your times in Australia and Japan, I mean, could you talk about what we're seeing in those two APAC markets in particular? You know, how are assets getting here? I mean, we tend to focus on the broken hills of the world, James, where the results are most extreme. James, you maybe want to go first on Australia.
Yeah, and I should caveat, you know, that's the most extreme example. Most assets really only experience a couple of percentage point movements in their loss factor from year to year. On the curtailment side, picking up on what Rowan said earlier about step changes in how that can change depending on new generation coming in or line upgrades coming in, you know, that's been one of the things that we found a lot of clients coming to us to work on, because we have had some assets in Australia very significantly curtailed, either because of there's too much power flowing through the line, or because there's too many solar farms in one part of the grid and there's all sorts of other system security issues that are causing problems. Often these issues resolve when new upgrades come in, new transmission upgrades come in. And the consequence for asset owners who are wanting to understand the possible futures for their project is that they need to run sensitivities around that. You know, it's putting out a curtailment forecast is going to be quite dependent on the future augmentations of the grid. And so running sensitivities to see what happens if that transmission comes late is quite important. And sensitivities, not just on, you know, if it comes late, how does that affect your curtailment, but also how does that affect the broader market? Because to an extent, these things can counteract. You know, if delayed transmission grids means you might have worse curtailment, but actually wholesale prices go up because everybody else also has worse curtailment. So accurately capturing the way that these interact is quite important for getting a realistic view.
Yeah, maybe just adding on that in the kind of Japan context, I think it's often where does the risk pop up for the asset owner? And like Hugo, to your point earlier, like GB is it's a kind of single price market, but you have these kind of transmission charges, these CHUOS or DUOS charges. Japan, it's popping up increasingly in like non-firm connections and curtailment. In Australia, it's the marginal loss factor. And then it comes down to like just how complicated is that particular regulatory framework to forecast. And so the impact then for the asset owner is just like when choosing between these markets, and I think this is increasingly true of the big global developers, it's actually also thinking about, okay, there's great potential in X market that's just liberalized, but the regulatory framework is really complicated in how they deal with stuff. That's a big risk factor. And how likely are they to like retrospectively change things? Kento and I were having a conversation the other day about this in the context of Japan and METI and like making policy decisions as government, like how that sends a signal to investors if you ever make changes that retroactively talk about change what was previously agreed on. It just changes the investment signal.
Makes complete sense. I'm conscious of time here. So we may wrap up with the third topic, which was, you know, what are we seeing? Markets are smart. They adapt where there are sharp locational signals or, you know, an absence of additional transmission, which creates issues on the grid. We do see market participants adjust. James, Rowan, again, I might throw this to you. You know, what kind of are you seeing? How are clients responding to some of the grid challenges in the respective markets that you work in?
In Australia in particular, we're seeing, first of all, on generation projects, we run grid studies as standard, pretty much as part of every transaction. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to just get a, you know, generation weighted average price. You do really need to run those grid studies. In addition to that, we're seeing a lot more interest in battery co-location. We've done tons of projects in Australia for renewables that look at adding a battery, both to smooth out the overall portfolio returns and also to mitigate some of the grid risk, because in times of congestion, you know, you can charge the battery at, you know, potentially for free and then redispatch later on. We've looked a lot of the benefits here, and oftentimes what we find is that actually the biggest benefit from co-location is just the CapEx saving, especially if, you know, you've got a solar farm and a battery and you can do a DC connection and just have one inverter. But that is not to say that's the only benefit. Of course, there can be these grid savings as well. They just are somewhat challenging to model, particularly because, as we've noted, grid outcomes can change a lot from year to year with the entry and exit of new capacity and transmission.
Rowan?
The two I might add to that, I definitely agree with both of those. And I think that's, it's not just Australia, it's Japan, it's some of the US as well. Co-location, thinking about how you do the forecasting. The other ones I'd probably add are people increasingly thinking about kind of innovative contracting or hedging instruments to kind of manage some of the risk. Mm-hmm. And this is where kind of in full locational marginal pricing systems, you almost have this kind of concept of like basis risk, because you contract against the like a single reference hub price, which then is a liquid forward market that you can do. But then you need to think about the kind of basis risk to your particular node. So I think that's one element. And then the other aspect I think increasingly we're seeing is, and we touched briefly on it earlier, is that idea of like renewable energy zones or government building out infrastructure to areas to like, it's a little bit this combination of a little bit of central planning to kind of facilitate the energy transition in a timely fashion, rather than assuming that it will all kind of work perfectly and smoothly. And increasingly, I think we're seeing market participants call for more of that to say, look, government, this is something where you could help provide clarity on transmission and some level of guarantee or assurity that grid is going to be less of an issue for me as an investor.
Yeah. And I think the only other two that I'd point to, and both the previous guests of the podcast, I mean, one is really where you do have a strong grid connection is creating the fully integrated hub. So James, you were pushing in this direction, but renewables, batteries, but also centers of demand, whether that's data centers or hydrogen electrolyzers, whatever that looks like. I think the other one is just kind of better leveraging of the existing network. And sorry, Sheldon Kimber talks a lot about that, US renewable developer. The second one is about better leveraging existing grid capacity, either through new technologies or through kind of better modeling of available capacity. And Jack Curtis from NERA came on the pod a few months ago to talk about the software that they're using to do exactly that in the Australian, US and Japanese context. So there are a couple of other themes that are pretty consistently coming up in our work. Team, thank you enormously for your time. I certainly enjoyed the conversation and you were all terrific. Thank you to our listeners as well. We're very appreciative.
That was Hugo Batten, Aurora's Managing Director for APAC, talking to Kento Yoshimura, Market Lead for Japan, Rowan von Spreckelsen, Head of New Markets for APAC, and James Ha, Research Lead for APAC. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to follow or subscribe to the podcast via whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening and goodbye.